Palestinian Dreaming, Arabs and Jews, Israel, and Palestine. This is Hearing Voices from NPR, the best of public radio, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This week, two dreams of the Holy Land. The first, told by Joe Frank.
He lived in a poor Arab village. The main street was an unpaved dirt road. Water was brought in by truck three times a week, from which his family filled their plastic jugs. And the electricity, which ran the TVs, the lights, and the fans, was provided by local generators powered by gasoline. His father had lost both legs to an artillery shell in the 1967 war. Now confined to a wheelchair, he was a devout Muslim who decried the existence of Israel. At the local mosque, he called for attacks on Israeli towns and cities and extolled the bravery of Hamas fighters, willing to risk their lives by murdering Jews. On the hill above the village, a new Israeli settlement was being built. So far, only a few concrete buildings with fortifications, surveillance outposts, and a perimeter of barbed wire. One day, a Hamas recruiter came to his school to enlist children as suicide bombers. Wishing to avenge his father, he began training. They wanted him to approach the new Israeli settlement dressed as a Hasidic student and blow himself up at the guard post. They fitted him with a vest with 8 sticks of dynamite, around which were ball bearings and nails, so that when he detonated the bomb, a cloud of shrapnel would explode outward, maiming and killing as many Israeli soldiers as possible. And so one morning, he found himself wearing a long black overcoat and a beaver hat, making his way up the road to the new settlement. He kept his eyes downcast and walked quickly, as though he was on an errand, when he heard a young Jewish soldier at the gate call out to him, "Stop. Who are you? Where are you going? If you take one more step, I will be forced to shoot." His heart pounding and his body drenched with perspiration, he ignored the soldier's warning and continued moving forward, his thumb poised on the button that would detonate the bomb. When, suddenly, he woke up and realized he was not an Arab boy about to kill himself and murder others, but an Israeli soldier who'd fallen asleep at his post overlooking the very Arab village he just dreamt he was from. Born in the Orthodox Jewish community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, he'd only recently come to Israel with his family. Now in the army, and no longer under the thumb of his strictly religious father, he had renounced his faith and become a secular Jew. The truth is that he had come to hate God. In his view, the deity was nothing more than a cruel and malicious old pervert. He imagined God pacing from room to room in his mansion in heaven, dreaming up new catastrophes on earth. African famine, genocide, and pandemic disease were deeply satisfying to him. But his greatest achievement remained the Nazi death camps of the 1940s. Nevertheless, the future was full of promise, with the proliferation of chemical, biological, and atomic weapons already being carried in the briefcases, backpacks, and heels of psychopathic religious killers. Yes, the future was rife with wonderfully hellish scenarios, and while God waited impatiently for them to unfold, he liked to keep things interesting with a plane crash, a forest fire, a ship lost at sea, a hostage crisis gone terribly wrong. If God were a resident on Earth, he thought, he would be considered criminally insane. And now he was looking down the road at a young Hasidic student quickly approaching on foot, the same figure he'd imagined himself to be in his dream. And he called out, "Stop! Who goes there? Who are you? Who are you visiting? What is your purpose?" But the young Hasid didn't answer. And he called out again, "If you do not stop, I will be forced to shoot." But even this warning did not deter the student, who continued to approach. And he called out again, "One more step, and I will open fire." and the only thing that prevented him from doing so was his awareness of the existence of a deaf Hasid who lived in a nearby settlement, considered a saint on earth, one of Israel's most treasured scholars. From infancy, he'd been able to read the Talmud, and now, barely a teenager, he'd already written brilliant commentaries on Holy Scripture that raised profound questions rather than offer narrow, dogmatic answers. It was said that he was beyond religion. And so, either this deaf saint or a would-be suicide bomber wearing a kaftan and a beaver hat continued to approach, unresponsive to the young soldier's warnings. And soon he would be close enough to hurl a grenade and to press the button on an exploding vest to blow up a bunker, allowing a small army of Arab assassins to come in and destroy the settlement. Now approaching the checkpoint at this very moment was the pastor of a church in Willow Cross, Mississippi. He was riding with his family in their Ford Explorer. They'd spent that afternoon at the Israeli settlement as guests of the chief rabbi there, where the pastor had enjoyed a wonderfully stimulating conversation with their host on the question, to whom is the Holy Land more sacred? The pastor spoke of his respect for the Jews, insofar as they were the original people of the book. But this land, he argued, was where God's only son had been brought to Bethlehem, where, on Golgotha, Jesus had been crucified and resurrected 3 days later. This was where Jesus had walked among the people and preached and performed miracles, healing the sick, raising the dead, feeding the thousands with a single fish and a loaf of bread. This was where, at the Last Supper, he'd learned who would betray him and who would remain his disciples. So this was sacred and hallowed Christian ground. And now the pastor and his wife and son and daughter were riding down a road on their way out of the Israeli settlement, singing, "My Bible for a Road Map," when they saw the young Hasid trudging toward the guard post. And as they approached him, the pastor experienced a blinding flash, then profound silence for what seemed like an eternity, and then the ear-splitting thunder of an explosion. And he felt a rush of hurricane-like wind and could feel the car lifted high above the road and slowly spinning in the air in an arc through empty space. And his last thoughts were for his wife and 2 children. When he woke up and realized he'd been dreaming. He was at home in Mississippi. It was one of those warm, balmy summer nights. He could hear the branches of the willow tree brushing against the side of the roof, the sound of a distant freight train, and a dog barking. The dream had been so terrifying that he found himself drenched with sweat, and yet, at the same time, felt chilled to the bone, his body trembling. He looked over and observed his wife sleeping. Then he saw the packed suitcases, the passports laid out on a table next to the American Express traveler's checks, and remembered they were about to fly to the Holy Land. He looked at the alarm clock, its glowing phosphorescent dial reading 5:10, and knew that in a few minutes the alarm would go off, because they had to be at the airport by 7. He rose from his bed and walked down the hall to the children's room and looked in at his son and daughter, who were sleeping, his little girl hugging her doll, his son sucking his thumb, his new baseball mitt on the floor beside his bed. Then he went downstairs, poured 2 fingers of Jack Daniels into a water glass, and drank it down. And he walked out onto the porch and listened to the crickets and the wind rustling the leaves of the willow tree. And he could not help but feel that his dream was a foreshadowing of what was to come, a tragic vision of the future. His family was excited about going to Palestine. For his wife, a devout Christian, this was the trip of a lifetime. This was where she would be able to touch the very soil upon which Jesus had walked. Then he heard the alarm clock ring and saw a light go on in the upstairs bedroom, and then a dimmer light in the curtained hallway window. and then another light in the children's bedroom. And he heard the faint sound of a faucet being turned on, and the excited voices of his children, and a radio turned to bluegrass music. And he walked out onto the lawn and knelt and clasped his hands and looked up at the star-filled sky and asked God for guidance. But he heard nothing but the sound of the crickets and the wind and a distant freight train that was taking forever to pass. And seen from high above, the freight train was moving along a river, beyond which was a fenced-off field in which horses were quietly standing and sleeping, and barns and outbuildings and fields of cotton, and a small town with a single main street leading to a courthouse square with a monument of a Confederate soldier on a pedestal with the names of the dead from the town, and steepled churches, and single and two-lane blacktops feeding into a larger interstate with steady traffic, and then suburbs and feeder roads and shopping centers and malls and gas stations and used car lots and bridges over rivers leading into cities with their capital buildings and business districts and residential high-rises and hospitals and stadiums and concert halls, their lights still twinkling as dawn was creeping over the horizon, and beyond that, enormous plains and great forests and huge river systems leading to the foothills of purple mountains that ran north and south, and beyond that, the sparkling expanse of deep blue oceans and the contours of Europe and Asia, where there was a light side and a dark side as the globe turned in the sunlight. And seen from even higher above and at a greater distance, the earth receding into a small stone in the firmament, and further back, our solar system disappearing into the Milky Way, and further back yet, into the darkness of the most profound silence imaginable, in the endless, the unknowable, and the infinity of time and space, without beginning or end.
Joe Frank from his hour Time's Arrow. He's at joefrank.com. Music by Air. You're hearing Voices this week, Palestinian Dreaming. Our next dream is real. Here's Sandy Tolan of Homelands Productions from 1998, The Lemon Tree.
Bashir al-Hayri was six when his family fled the town of Ramleh in old Palestine. It was July 1948, 2 months after Britain's withdrawal from Palestine, Israel's declaration of statehood, and the beginning of the Arab-Israeli War. By July 1948, the balance of power had shifted toward the Jewish state. Israel launched an offensive to establish a corridor between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The Palestinian cities of Lod and Ramleh were in the line of that assault, and Bashir, 6 years old, suddenly found himself a refugee in the West Bank town of Ramallah. 3 months later, Dalia Ashkenazi arrived in Israel from Bulgaria. Dalia was an infant. She was told she was the only one on the boat who didn't get sick. Dalia's family escaped the Holocaust, like most Bulgarian Jews, yet nearly all of them, 50,000, moved as one to the new Jewish state. Dalia's family moved to Ramleh, the town Bashir's family had fled. For 19 years, Bashir's family lived in exile in the West Bank. Dalia's went about making a new society. But after the Six-Day War, many Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza were allowed to enter Israel to visit their old homeland. Bashir remembered his father's stories of the land of Palestine, the house in Ramleh, and the family's cherished lemon tree. And so one day in July 1967, Bashir found himself in an Israeli bus station in West Jerusalem. That's where our story begins.
كل ما في المحطة صامت وبارد. الجو والوجوه. أقترب من مرآة مثبتة على أحد الجدران.
Everything at the station is cold and silent. The walls and the faces. I approach a mirror on the wall and have a look at myself, as if to make sure I was suited for the encounter. as if I were preparing to meet a lover. My cousin woke me from my thoughts. The bus is leaving.
Whenever I heard a language, it was a language that was filled with threat for me, the language of the enemy. We knew there was a propaganda against the so-called Zionism, whatever that meant to the Arabs, trying to convince us that Israel was not our place. The choice was either you go on your ships back to where you came from, or we push you into the sea. Some choice.
We were three, my two older cousins and me. Each of us chose a window seat, sitting in a row, one behind the other. We were filled with infinite dreams.
The fear and the horror of it cannot be described. The Six-Day War was in 67, so I was 19, 20 years old. You know, you just felt completely entrapped. That's how we felt. And we were biting our nails, not knowing what should we do now, you know, what?
The journey began. It was a journey of expectations, a journey of love and pain. We devoured each scene that passed before our eyes. Who would have thought that we would have entered our homeland as strangers?
I will never forget it. The fact that we couldn't be accepted here, it was very clearly stated, and because we who have just come out from Europe, we had to take sick fantasies seriously. I had repeated dreams night after night as I was growing up of Nazis in Israel, you know, trying to round me and my family and my friends up. Wherever we escaped, they were there. If we went this alleyway, they would come up this way. And if we came this alleyway, there was no way out.
We got off the bus. And at that moment, memories came rushing back. As if 18 years had never passed. We were in our hometown, speaking our own language, walking freely down our old streets in Ramleh.
From time to time, I would ask my parents and other people who were the people who lived in these Arab houses before and why did they leave? And we were always told, people fled and left the boiling soup on the table, you know. So it sounded like some kind of a cowardly escape.
We were walking toward my house. I was confronting the unknown, lost in thought. How was I going to be received in that house? Who was going to be behind those closed doors?
And I sort of tried to imagine what it is like to be so afraid that one would have to leave everything.
Have you ever seen a lover drawn with a hidden magic toward his shrine, pulled by an invisible power that is beyond his comprehension? That was my state when a voice came from my depths. This is my home.
And I was in a summer vacation from the university, alone at home. My parents were working.
I was wary. Should I knock forcefully and risk intimidating the people inside? Or knock softly and risk that the people would not hear me? I looked for the bell. I found the bell. I pressed the bell.
And the doorbell of the big gate rang.
I was taking everything in. I looked at the walls of the house, the windows, the trees. I saw the flowering tree. It had beautiful scent. And the towering palm tree, taller than the house. And I saw the lemon tree. After a few seconds, I heard a voice in Hebrew saying, "Kien kien," which means yes.
And when I opened, I saw these three men with suits and ties in the summer of July in Israel.
And I found myself face to face with a young woman in her 20s.
I saw them, and it was as if it was a revelation. I knew who they were. They were very wary and very shy, and they didn't know how they would be received. But it was like in a split second, it was like as if I was always waiting for them.
I told her, "I am the son of the man who owned the house, who lived here before 1948, and I lived here too."
It is very strange, but I knew at that moment that it was like completing a puzzle. It was like the second part of an unfinished reality was there, confronting me.
And I said, "Is it possible for me to come in and see the house?"
And I opened the door wide and I said, "Yes, to come in."
Coming up, more of The Lemon Tree from Homelands Productions with original music by Dorothy Wang. We're back in a minute with Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are hearing voices. From 1998, we continue with Sandy Tolan of Homelands Productions and The Lemon Tree.
I said, "We haven't been properly introduced. I am Bashir, and these are my two cousins." She said, "I am Dalia, and I study at Tel Aviv University." She entered, and I followed her, and we started going around the house. Every room I entered, I felt that I was entering a sacred place. I tried to touch everything, to take in everything. The walls, the doors, the ceiling, the windows, the floors, the colors, everything. She asked me, "When you left, how old were you?" I said, "Around 6 years old." She said, "I came here when I was 1 year old." "Where did you sleep?" she asked me. "Which was your room?" And that conversation was taking place in the room where I slept when I was a child. And she said, "This is where I sleep. This is my room."
My recollection is that Bashir said that this was the room where he was born. I became very self-conscious then that I put a poster on the wall that was then on the cover of Life magazine of a handsome officer in the Suez Canal with an Uzi, holding an Uzi in his hand with a big smile, like saying, "We've made it." And I was at the time very proud of this image, which was a symbol of liberation and warding off a threat and being alive. And there was this poster over my bed, you know. I suddenly realized that they must be looking at this poster with very different eyes and very different feelings than I do.
We said goodbye, we gave her our address, and we invited her to visit us in Ramallah. We thanked her for her reception and her kindness. She said, "You can come anytime. The house will be open for you." We went back to Ramallah by bus, carrying new burdens on our chests. And then Dahlia started visiting our house. She came unannounced. We were surprised when she entered the house. Of course, I invited her, but we had not set a date.
When I came there, it was an amazing experience. Because, you know, the whole family came and they looked at this strange being. So it seemed to me, you know, was living in their home, and this was probably the first Israeli they ever saw. And they brought all these wonderful cookies and tea and coffee, and I felt very safe and protected among them.
We sat and talked about politics and religion and literature. We talked about how we were dispossessed and about the unfolding of the Palestinian tragedy.
I said, okay, you know, I live in your home, and this is also my home. It's the only home I know. So what shall we do? You know, there was a problem of language. And Bashir spoke some English, so we started talking about my home, your home. And I started expressing my understanding of their sense of exile through my longing to Zion, to Zion, to Israel.
They feel that a homeland means security. And outside this homeland, they are despised. But Palestine, geographically and demographically, is part of a bigger Arab world. It's in the middle of a sea of Arab culture. I used to tell her, you dream of living on an isolated island where you can practice a pure Jewish life is like the fantasy of Robinson Crusoe. It's a fantasy. It's not real.
You see, sometimes we hear, yes, the state of Israel exists just because of the Holocaust. The only moral justification is the Holocaust. And there are some very deep components. It's not just memory. It's the spiritual nourishment that comes from these memories. Because otherwise, how can we understand the survival of the Jewish people against all odds, you know?
They build their yearnings and dreams on myth. We base our dreams on the bones of our ancestors, on our history here. It's difficult for us to understand how they see history with one eye. They don't look at the facts that they don't want to see. There are 4 million Palestinians living in exile. Why should they remain abroad? The solution is one secular, democratic state where everyone lives equally.
I felt that the two things were happening simultaneously. On the one hand, On the personal level, there was the establishment of a bond through a common fate. And this was an amazing situation to be in, you know. Everybody could feel the warmth and the reality of here people are meeting and meeting the other, and it was real and it was happening. And on the other hand, intellectually, we were conversing of things that we couldn't see, possibly see how. They seemed totally mutually exclusive. That my life here is at their expense, and if they want to realize their dream, it's at my expense.
I felt that with every conversation, with every dialogue we had, there was a change taking place in the way she was thinking about us.
And I felt that I was incredibly accepted. Just the very fact that I opened that door gave me trust and a gratitude that I cannot even express in words, because I've never met such gratitude before, just for the fact that I opened that door.
At approximately 5 minutes to 10 this morning, Jerusalem time, a bomb exploded outside one wing of the lawn.
We saw blood, wounded people, suffering, pain, dead people. These are some of the pictures that I can really remember.
Matthew Holton of the CBC in London says the British feel that the stage is set for a terrible and bloody civil war in the Holy Land. He reports from London.
The Jews are confident and determined. They defy the whole Arab world.
After I met Bashir, I obviously wanted to know much more about 48. And a student at the university who was studying with me had participated in the 48 war, and he told me about the expulsions from Ramle and Lod. He told me that, yes, they committed these expulsions by frightening the population and driving them out.
We took refuge in a nearby house. Part of it was transformed into a mobile clinic. My uncle was a doctor, and they used to bring in wounded people.
There was the big scandal of Rabin's memoirs. The censorship in Israel had censored those parts in which he speaks of the expulsions from Ramle and Lod. But, of course, the book in its English version came with a full account.
We were faced with occupation troops. They demanded by force of arms we leave that house.
That's the house that we came to. It was in Ramla, and we lived in this Arab house, which the state took responsibility for, and it was called abandoned property. I'm laughing because it was not abandoned, really. People were expelled, but it was a comfortable expression.
We moved along like human waves, packed in tight clusters, filled with fear and exhaustion, walking towards the unknown. We had a dignified life. The moment we lost our country, we lost everything. الاحتلال اللي أجا وقعد محل.
One day, Bashir's father came, and he was blind and old, and had to be, you know, really supported when he walked. He touched the stones of the house, and after touching the stones, he said to my father, "There was a lemon tree in the garden, which I planted. Is it still alive?" So my father took him to the tree, and Ahmed, stood there. He was crying silently. And my father took a bunch of lemons and gave it to him. And later I heard from Bashir's mother that when he couldn't sleep at night, he would hold these lemons and walk up and down, and that they kept them for years. You know, they shriveled more and more, and they kept them for years just there as something from the house and a gift and a memory. And then came the big shock.
More outbursts of violence and bloodshed in the Middle East.
Israeli 1969. You know, there was this explosion in Agron supermarket in Jerusalem.
A bomb explosion in a Jerusalem supermarket.
Explosives were put in a jam jar on the shelf. And the supermarket exploded and people were killed and wounded. And
more on this from Michael Elkins in Jerusalem.
Two bombs were placed in the supermarket. The first, which exploded, consisted of 4 or 5 kilos of dynamite. The second, which did not explode and was found in a large tin used for storing sweets, was smaller, about 2 kilos of dynamite. It is, of course, natural that suspicion falls upon the Arabs, and that the 150 persons, or perhaps more, who have been hauled in for investigation are Arabs. The police officers would not say when the bomb...
My father, Moshe, called me one day and said, well, look what's in the papers. You know that Bashir is convicted as having taken part in this. He was charged with being the liaison person between those who gave the explosives and those who put them in the jar. And as far as I know, it's an act attributed to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Well, Bashir is identified with this movement. The person who appeared at my door, I've learned later, of course, was an activist for the Popular Front. Anyways, after this, I felt so betrayed that all connections stopped with the family. He was in jail anyway, so... But, yeah, everything stopped. No contact.
يعني التهمة كتهمة تهمة بطلة لأنه يعني لو أنا بالفعل كنت ما عديش اعتراف فيها.
There were false accusations. Because if they had been able to prove them, I would have been sentenced to life in prison, not for 15 years.
I used to walk by the Ramla prison every day on my way to work. And I was having thoughts whether I should go and check if Bashir was in that prison, because it's a very large prison for long-term prisoners. And I never did it. You think of it every day, you know. But yeah, I felt very betrayed, and it was too much for me.
I did not confess, and they could not extract a confession from me. However, I am Palestinian. I have always hated occupation. And I believe that I have the right to resist it by the means that are available to me. Yes, at one stage, the means were violent. But I understood them. I understood the actions of the Palestinian fighters who are ready to sacrifice themselves. I still understand them.
I believed he was guilty. I still believe so. And I would be the happiest person on earth to be disabused of this notion. Indeed, I was for many years waiting for a letter saying, I never did this. Or a conversation, if I did this, I'm very, very sorry. But I never received such a letter. But I am his friend, yes? Am I his friend or not? If I'm his friend, he can tell me frankly, I had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And yet, he belongs to an organization which puts it on its agenda to destroy Israel, also through terror actions. so-called armed struggle. Bombing buses and so on, where also Palestinians are, and also Palestinian children can be, because terror is indiscriminate. And I can be on one of these buses, too.
We have suffered many massacres. Duwaymi, Kfar Qasim, Deir Yassin, Sabra al Shatila. In the face of all these massacres, dispossession, if anybody thought that a Palestinian would react like Jesus Christ would have, he is wrong. If I didn't have this deep conviction to the bone marrow in the necessity of hating the occupation, I don't deserve to be a Palestinian. This feeling, political feeling, started at the age of 6 when we were expelled.
As a 6-year-old, they were in Gaza where they had land, and he was playing with a hand grenade.
And we were playing in the neighborhood with kids, and we thought it was a toy. It was a bomb. It exploded in my hand.
And 4 of his fingers were blown out. Now, can you imagine the trauma of a 6-year-old who is sure is playing with a toy and it explodes in his hands? And he is sure that the Zionists have put it there for him, for little children to be blown up. I mean, what kind of an impression does that leave on somebody's mind who later goes and participates in doing pretty much the same to other people?
Those were the gifts, the presence of the Zionist movement to the children of Palestine. If you just start playing with them, they explode.
I never saw his left hand. His left hand is always in his pocket. Have you seen his left hand? You've met him. No, you shook his right hand. You've never seen his left hand. His left hand is hidden, and it's hidden so well, you never know, you've never seen it.
For me, what I lost in bones and flesh in Palestine made me more attached to Palestine. This is what I told them when they wanted to deport me. I said, "You are only deporting parts of my body, but there are some parts of my body that you have no control over. It's already there, buried in Palestine, and I am coming back."
When Bashir wrote to me about his hand, I didn't know of this story, actually. I was quite shocked. And I was also shocked that he expressed the conviction that this was left there against Palestinian children as toys that to play with and to be exploded. I was amazed at the intensity of his perception that Zionism was this incredibly evil manifestation, and that this was his experience. And I am a child of Zion. For me, Zion means something very different than it means to him. For me, Zion is the mountain of God. For me, it's an expression of my very ancient longing. For me, it's a word that symbolizes a harbor for my people and our collective expression here. And for him, it's a regime of terror. That's what it is for him. Something that it's an obligation to fight and to resist in every possible way. Because if Zionism for him is a reign of terror, then terror is an appropriate answer. And I say that I cannot afford being on that point where you fight one wrong with another wrong. It doesn't lead you anywhere.
Bashir spent 15 years in prison for his alleged role in the bombing of the Jerusalem market. Dalia lost touch with the family after cutting off all contact, but she kept thinking of Bashir and the house and their common fate.
Still, during all these 16 years, I was thinking of the tragedy of the vicious circle. Pain, retaliation. It can go on and on. And I also felt that this house belonged to a family, a whole family, you know, of 13 people. I felt a very deep need to acknowledge that. So my mother died in 77 and my father died in 85. I told Yecheskel, my husband, what do you feel about searching out the family? So there was a meeting, and I saw Bashir after all these years. So we said, here is the house. How do you envision its future? You know, we were open. We said we are ready to pay reparations, or how do you call it, compensation, for your loss of property, you know. And we knew they couldn't live in the house by Israeli law. So if it's sold, you will get the money of it. And Bashir said, no selling, and now this is my patrimony, and I don't...
وَقَدَّمْتِ عَرْضِكِ بِإِعَادَةِ الْبَيْتِ لِي.
And we agreed, according to my suggestion, to turn the house into a daycare center for Arab children.
I've done something very personal. I wanted to take responsibility for the suffering that my people has caused them, the Palestinian people. I believe that God is God of abundance and not God of scarcity. And therefore many things are possible.
Hello, welcome to the open house. Here's Bashir and Dalia's house. This is where Bashir and Dalia lived, different times. We are standing near the lemon tree. Unfortunately, the lemon tree is dead. The lemon tree is now, he's 65 years old and he's dead.
The lemon tree died in the summer after many years of decline. And the gardener warned us that the tree is going to die and said, well, this is the nature of things. Things just die on this planet, you know. And still it was such a surprise, pain, such a pain. And when we saw it finally dead, we have left the tree there, bare. And just yesterday when I was there, I picked a shriveled lemon from the ground. And I'm keeping it. one of the last falling, dried up lemons that are falling off the branches. And the tree will stand there as long as it can. It stands there. Trees die standing.
That tree was living in our hearts. And the lemon fruit is not just a fruit. It's a buried childhood in each of us. It is our memories. It is our compassion. It is our country. This lemon is Palestine.
And it is my dream that with the Al-Khairi family, we can, when the time is right, we can plant a new sapling lemon tree together.
وتمنيت ألا تكون الدالية الوحيدة. وتمنيت أن أعيش لأرى غابة من الداليات.
I had hoped that you would not be the only Dahlia. I had hoped to live to see a forest of Dahlias. And we had many expectations. I don't want to overburden you, Dahlia. I know how sensitive you are. I don't wish you any pain. All what I wish, Dahlia, is for you to struggle with me, to reunite me with my palm. My palm that has blended with every grain of Palestinian soil.
جمعي بكفي كفي الملتحمة بكل ذرة من ذرات تراب فلسطين مع خالص التقدير لكم.
I love my country, and you love your country. And I love your country, too. And it is the same country. And I have nowhere else to go, and you have nowhere else to go. So we are here. And nobody will dream the other way. And our enemy is the only partner we have.
The Lemon Tree premiered in 1998 on Fresh Air, thanks to Danny Miller and Terry Gross. Editorial help from Chris Ballman and Chris Brooks. Original music by Dorothy Wang. Sandy Tolan produced the story and wrote the book, The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. His work is online at homelands.org. I'm Barrett Golding of HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.